I'm a werewolf.
Tomorrow night's the full moon. You're gonna change. You'll become...
I know. A monster.
You've gotta kill yourself, David. Before it's too late.
Welcome to Now Playing Podcast's bonus American Werewolf retrospective series.
Everybody dies in it. Very bloody.
Hosted by Jacob.
I thought you'd be glad to see me.
Stuart.
I find you very attractive and a little bit sad.
And Arnie.
I love you, Americans. What great taste you have.
But be warned, this episode will contain detailed plot spoilers and strong language.
Please, remain sane. At least until you're no longer our responsibility.
We hope you enjoy the show.
Beware the moon, and stick to the road.
Today we're discussing An American Werewolf in London, starring David Naughton, Jenny Agutter, Griffin Dunn, John Woodvine, directed by John Landis. This is your podcasting putz, Arnie.
And Stuart.
This is Jacob, and yeah, I'm gonna say it. Shakespeare's French.
Thank you, silver donors, or should I say silver bullet donors, for going werewolf for us in this Christmas season. Why are we doing American Werewolf in London, and why are we doing it now?
Is this in show or out of show? You sound really confused.
Yeah, it seems like this kind of horror stuff would be more fitting around Halloween, but we're doing werewolves over on the main feed. We're leading up to Lee Winnell's The Wolfman, and there were some Wolfman movies that we aren't covering on the main feed that deserve to be looked at. They're not Universal Pictures Wolfman movies, but they're classics unto their own right, primarily classics from the 80s that then have sequels.
Last Christmas, we were doing Home Alone. This one... American Werewolf in London, which is a comedy. I have to remind myself. I always think of it as a horror movie because of the acclaimed special effects. The transformation scene is so influential. But it is coming to us from a comedy guy. John Landis is not a horror guy. And I do think it makes sense when you have that perspective. Animal House, Blues Brothers. This was the movie he made between Blues Brothers and Trading Places.
Don't call it a comedy. He'll get upset. Even in 1981, he was out there saying, don't call this a comedy film. It's a film that has some humor, but this is a horror film through and through.
According to him.
He knew that there would be some laughs. He had some trouble getting it made because people couldn't figure out exactly what it was supposed to be. He wrote this film when he was very young. He wrote it in the late 60s. And used it as a spec script to get other jobs, but nobody wanted to make this movie until he had the back-to-back successes of Animal House and Blues Brothers, and then he finally was able to get the money and the funding to go do this horror movie he'd wanted to do for over a decade.
He actually had made this movie before. I don't know if you guys ever saw it, but as a kid, I just thought it was hysterical. It was called Schlock. It was about, like, this gorilla monster that terrorizes, I think it's California. I just remember he has a scene where he goes into a movie theater and keeps pointing at the candy, and the concession girl just keeps giving him more and more candy. I don't know why I thought that was hysterical. I was 7 years old. But, yeah, he had already made fun of the horror genre in a much more farcical way. And this one, yeah, it's a little more nuanced. It could be argued. I think we'll probably have that debate. How much horror, how much comedy? Where would you put it in your theoretical video store? Which section?
Although the studio was pressuring him to hire Belushi and Aykroyd as the two stars, I think you'd be putting it definitely in the comedy section if you'd reunited the Blues Brothers for it.
Were they going to dance with the werewolves?
Yeah, I could see that. It would definitely take away some of that nuance I'm talking about, but I could see them making a version of this movie. When did you guys see this? I feel like it was always on cable when I was growing up, and I always saw bits, but I don't know that I ever saw it start to finish until this week.
Oh, I saw it. It had to be the late 90s. And I was with a group of friends, and they just started talking about this film, and I felt like a dummy because I had never seen it, and they're talking about this awesome transformation. So I'm like, well, now I need to go rent this movie and watch it. And so, yeah, it was at some point in the late 90s.
I very clearly remember my first time watching this film. It was fall of 2001. I was unemployed, and I was just in a major horror mood. I was picking up tons of horror DVDs, and while Marjorie went to work all day every day, I stayed home and tried to cram as many horror movies in as I could every single day. And I hadn't seen American Werewolf in London, but I'd seen American Werewolf in Paris. I saw that in theaters.
That was your first?
That was my first.
Wow. And you wanted to see this after that?
We'll talk about it, but I had very good memories of that film.
Wow, okay.
And then I was buying Movie Maniacs figures from McFarlane, Leatherface, The Fly, The Thing, and they came out with a werewolf from American Werewolf in London. I bought that figure. Never saw the movie, but they had this collector's edition two-disc DVD in 2001. I was so excited. I watched that movie, and I was like, huh, I bought figures for this? I bought the DVD of this? And then I just tried to understand the fandom, because I didn't love it on my first watching. And so I listened to the commentaries, and I watched the makings of, and I just tried to wrap my mind around why this movie I'd read about for so long in Fangoria magazine and everything was so beloved, because I didn't get it.
Arnie, you understand there's Nazi werewolves in this movie, right? Did you blink during that scene?
Yeah, blink and you miss them. I mean, they are barely in the movie, but they are in the movie. And I think I saw the movie one time since that 2001 viewing. So this is me coming back to it for the first time in probably about 20 years and seeing if I have changed my mind at all.
Yeah, honestly, I think for our generation, the legacy of this movie is the makeup effects, right? They invented a statue to give it. There was no best makeup effects before this movie, and this movie shocked so many people with its transformation scene. They said, we got to give Rick Baker something.
Well, they were going to do it anyway. Elephant Man had gotten backlash for not having an Oscar to give for those makeup effects. So something was going to win an Oscar for best makeup effects in 1981. But this movie came out, and it was a big year for Wolfman movies that year. I had seen The Howling, number one. I had seen Wolfen. I saw both of those back in the 80s. And yet I never saw American Werewolf until much later. But all three werewolf movies came out the exact same year.
It was a bit of a phenomenon going on. But I think this one was the biggest hit. Certainly the one that was most notorious. But again, that makeup effect. I just remember as a kid, I'd watch the movie until I'd seen that part. And then I'd be like, okay, moving on. I didn't even know what happened in the rest of the movie. It was about seeing a man in practical terms turn into a wolf before your eyes, which, again, Michael Jackson stole. A few years later, Rick Baker does it again with The King of Pop.
The true legacy of this film.
Yeah, I do think that Thriller is easier to watch. You know, it's shorter.
Yeah, and I mean, that video was directed by John Landis. They did bring in Rick Baker to do the effects. One of the exact same effects rigs was used in the Thriller video that's used in American Werewolf. There's a score to this movie, a little bit, by Elmer Bernstein, but Landis didn't use much of it. And so some of that unused score was actually used in the Thriller video as background music to make the transformation more eerie. When you're not hearing Quincy Jones and Michael's stuff, you're hearing Elmer Bernstein. Michael Jackson was a huge fan of this film, and called Landis, who brought basically the entire crew, the makeup people, the composer, everybody from American Werewolf, to go do Thriller. And I'll say, when I saw Thriller as a kid, and I was 8 years old at most, that video scared the hell out of me, especially those yellow eyes at the very end. Longtime listeners know how I am with eyes. And when Michael Jackson turned towards the camera with those yellow eyes, but the whole transformation, that's what I knew before I saw American Werewolf, was that as a kid, the legacy of this scared the hell out of me.
Which is crazy because that's like not even the main music video. He's a zombie most of that video. Like, he's just a werewolf at the beginning for a fake out.
I agreed. But again, what that leaves me with coming into this franchise, this whole series, is what does it mean to be an American werewolf in London? What is this movie about? Harney, give him the plot. We'll get into it.
David and Jack, played by David Naughton and Griffin Dunn, are two Americans backpacking through England. They get lost on the moors where Jack is attacked by a werewolf. The locals shoot and kill the wolf, which turns back into a man. Jack is killed and David is bitten. David wakes up 3 weeks later in a London hospital. Local authorities tell him that he was attacked by an escaped lunatic, and they don't believe David saying it was an animal. He starts to have hallucinations, and then the mutilated ghost of Jack appears. Jack tells David he's now a werewolf, and he needs to kill himself before he hurts anyone else. David tries to ignore these things and instead focus on his hot nurse Alex Price, played by Jenny Agutter. After being released from the hospital, David moves in with Alex. But soon the moon is full, and David turns into a werewolf. He goes out and kills several Londoners. He tries to tell this to Alex, but she doesn't believe him. David wakes up the next morning in the local zoo, naked and with no memory of what happened the night before. Jack's ghost appears, along with the ghosts of the other people David killed, and they all encourage David to commit suicide. But David turns into a werewolf again. He starts to attack people in Piccadilly Circus. He's eventually shot dead by police as credits roll.
As they start, how could you not call it a comedy? It begins with Blue Moon. That kind of referencing, that's a joke.
I mean, every song is about a moon. It probably has moon in the title. Like, yeah, every song is prominently something moon. It's rising, it's blue, it's whatever.
Yeah, they wanted to get other songs and couldn't get the rights. Apparently there was a Bob Dylan song about a moon or something like that. But no, we're going to get Blue Moon 3 times during this movie. And it does start with that. I do wish this movie had a little bit more of the score. I think Blue Moon... I'm sorry, when I think of Blue Moon, the song, I think of the movie Grease, where that's the slow dance after the dance off, and then the T-Birds come out and moon the camera. And so that's what I hear every time I hear Blue Moon. So yes, that is going to make me think of comedies and not think of werewolves.
Which again, my thesis is this is a comedy. When we see our two stars of this movie, it's a joke. They're stuffed in the back of a truck with a bunch of sheep. And they're regretting the fact that they didn't go to Italy first. They're backpacking through Europe, and they started in England doing a country tour at a time. I'm not sure exactly when this is, but England is pretty cool.
I can't even imagine this time of being a young adult without a cell phone and just going to another country with a backpack. Like, I'm going to hitchhike. People did it. I'm not saying that it's unrealistic. I'm just saying I can't imagine being so untethered that you're just in the countryside of England and like, oh, look, there's a pub called the Slaughtered Lamb and it's the only thing around. I guess we'll go in.
I'll say this as far as the tone, because yes, I would say this is comedic. I do think it's comedic in that way. And Landis ran around with the same groups that like Ghostbusters is, where are there a lot of jokes with punchlines, or is it just about this like sarcastic attitude, this anarchic behavior where just anything goes? And that is a type of comedy that I think you really got like in the 70s and 80s because of Landis. And I do feel this fits comfortably into that genre of comedy.
I don't think of it as Ghostbusters so much as another genre of comedy that was very prominent in the early 80s. The teen sex comedy, right? I mean, Landis himself did Animal House. And I think about Porky's coming out around the same time. These are two guys that are looking to get laid. They're talking about some girl back home. They're talking about all the women that they're going to find along the way. It has that kind of conquest. And again, I've always argued werewolves have a sexual connotation to them. So I think there is some sense in bringing the two genres together. But it kind of feels, I don't know, are these teenagers? They look a little old for that.
I think that they're 20-somethings.
They're in college.
Yeah. That's all he did. I mean, I think it's worth pointing out, he did things like Hot Dog the Movie. He didn't go on and do a bunch of horror movies. He's known for doing sex comedies.
Well, what's funny is when he got this job, he was known for being the Dr. Pepper guy. He was dancing in the commercials, Don't You Want to Be a Pepper Too? that's how he got this job. And then he got fired from Dr. Pepper for doing nudity in this movie. So he's no longer a Pepper because he showed his Pepper.
I'm a Pepper. You're a Pepper. I remember that very distinctly. And Griffin Dunn, of course, is the son of Dominic Dunn. His sister was the one that got killed in Poltergeist shortly thereafter. He recently wrote a book about his entire family. He always seems to have movies in which he's oppressed by something. Be it After Hours, he's oppressed by New York. Who's That Girl? He's oppressed by Madonna. And then he even had a movie where it was a talking dick movie, and he's oppressed by his own penis. Me and Him.
It's kind of the same thing in Johnny Dangerously. He's oppressed by his older brother and his balls.
So it's probably not a surprise to find out he's going to be the one that's going to get slaughtered as these two are going forward. But I'm curious, did you guys sense who was going to become the American Werewolf?
I think when I first watched this, because I've watched this a few times since, but when I first watched, I don't know, it's that red jacket that just stands out to me. It draws my eye to that character. So to me, it made me pay more attention to him the first time I watched this.
My memory was Griffin Dunn was the main character. Griffin Dunn is obviously the bigger actor now. I've seen Griffin Dunn in a lot more stuff. And so coming back, I'm like, so it's Griffin Dunn and somebody who's going to be a zombie around Griffin Dunn. And so at the beginning here, when the opening credits are rolling and Griffin Dunn doesn't have top billing, I'm like, wait a second. And then he gets killed pretty quick. And I'm like, oh, I got this backwards. Griffin Dunn is the comedy sidekick, not the main character. Okay.
Yeah, he's a little bit shorter, a little bit, yeah, I guess leading man material. But you could have flipped a coin. It could have been either one of them or both. I'm going to ask, because even now, I'm really curious. This title, American Werewolf in London, has Landis ever talked about why he called it that or why it's important that they're American?
Well, he was overseas working on various films in the 60s when he wrote this. He was an American in London himself. And so he was basing it on that experience. And then the title, he was looking at the old classic movie, An American in Paris, and the movie that we're reviewing on the main feed, Werewolf of London, and he kind of mixed those. Now, he did have a little bit of trouble getting a work permit for Griffin Dunn, and he did tell the people in London, you know, I can just rename this An American Werewolf in Paris and go to France where they're going to let Griffin Dunn work. So we almost had it be An American Werewolf in Paris. Landis played that card, and then Griffin Dunn was allowed to work.
Yeah, because I think of American tourism, the ugly American is a stereotype, right? We go to other countries, we don't speak the language, we demand that the locals follow our lead and flash our money around, and just generally, I mean, go to any foreign country, you'll see it. It's really embarrassing. Yeah, just hang outside a McDonald's or a Chili's, and you're going to see some really ugly Americans. But these guys are nice. If anything, I feel bad for them when they stop into this inn and everyone's giving them the cold shoulder for no apparent reason other than, I guess, they're foreigners.
Yeah, I don't think the ugly American was the stereotype in the early 80s that it would become. I think that tourism was kind of newer back then. I mean, people weren't even flying a lot until the 50s and 60s for recreation. So I think it took a few decades for us to really become terrible people.
And, you know, England is almost like going to America across the pond. You know, it's so similar. They speak the same language.
Oh, angry email, send them to Stuart.
Well, I mean, it is. It doesn't really feel that much like a foreign country, other than they drive on the wrong side of the road. You know, like, there's not a whole lot of cultural difference. Unlike, yeah, if they had gone to Paris, we have that stereotype of the French. You know, I do think there's more culture clash there. We would expect to be treated rudely in the Paris countryside.
But we do get into this pub here, which has some actors. I was watching this with Marjorie, and she recognized a couple of the British actors in this pub. I didn't recognize any of them myself, but she knew Rick Mayall. She really liked The Young Ones.
I remember the show. I didn't watch it.
Great show.
That was predating this movie, right? He got The Young Ones out of this?
Yeah, I think The Young Ones came a few years after this. I don't know that he got it out of this, but he continued to work and got it, yes.
Yeah, I don't think we're supposed to recognize anybody here. I think the point is just being greeted with stone faces. It's just kind of funny. Again, it's so awkward. It's cringe comedy. What are we doing here? Why do they have a pentagram on the wall? Why do they have the slaughtered lamb? It's just not an inviting name for an establishment. And then they don't serve food. So where's the lamb that I can eat? Why slaughter it?
Well, I gotta ask you, Stuart, because it seems like it's troubling you that there's humorous moments here, that it's maybe a comedy, because I think when we get into this tavern, there is comedy that definitely works. Like, they're trying to, yes, like you called out, get that food, get a tea, get a coffee. No, only spirits, only beer. There's stuff like that, but I also feel this really foreboding sense with these villagers where there is something scary, not just because there's a pentagram on the wall, but like, yeah, they definitely do not like these Americans showing up. So there are these light moments, but then there's also this sense of danger here. I think it's well balanced.
I agree. I think there's some good comedy when they're like, remember the Alamo, and the waitress is like, yeah, I saw that in London a couple years ago, the John Wayne movie. And John Landis grew up watching those Universal monster movies and, like discussed, the pentagram was the mark that the werewolf would kill you. And so he's bringing a lot of that lore into this movie intentionally. And just as an aside, there is a slaughtered lamb pub that opened in New York based on this place. I've been there. I went and ate there. It's in Greenwich Village, and they have good food. I recommend it if you're in Greenwich.
That's the most American thing to do. Here's our American version of your ethnic thing.
Yeah, I mean, I would expect you can't survive in New York unless you serve good food. So they better at least get that right.
But you can play darts there, and you get somebody here with a funny line when they're asking, what's the pentagram? You made me miss. I never miss. It's ominous, but it is funny.
Yeah, no, let me clarify in case you're hearing criticism. I'm not criticizing. I'm just saying it's a comedy. To me, this is predominantly 80% joke, or at least, you know, maybe not driven by more like gags than, I guess, punchlines. Scenarios are funny.
And is this a warning to those who haven't seen it before? Because this was always sold to me as being a comedy thing. That was never a mystery or a surprise to me that I'd be laughing during this.
I think it might be a surprise to some people that just hear the title.
And it certainly was to me. I wasn't expecting so many chuckles the first time I watched it. By the same token, I do think this movie changes. I think it does start very much in comedy. I think it ends very much in tragedy. I don't think this is a yuck fest the whole way through by any means. I definitely think it has true horror moments. It is not going to undercut its tension with humor later in the film.
Yeah, I agree with that. But, and it is a little bit creepy that, you know, once they're asked to leave or they take the hint and they're traveling along, we hear that howl. And they've been told, beware the moon, watch out for the moors. And wouldn't you know it, stupid Americans, they're off the beaten path and the howling is getting closer and closer.
It's a good opening. It lasts just the right amount of time. They're not sure where the sound is coming from. And before you know it, in just a flash, we don't really get to see the wolf, but we get to see Griffin Dunn on the ground. David's running like hell and then turns around to come back for his friend, which is a very realistic reaction, I think. You'd initially fight or flight. You try to get out of the way, but then you realize your friend needs help. And the people from the bar show up and shoot the hell out of it. And now there's a naked dude on the ground.
Well, I love the whole buildup to this attack because, yeah, you will cut back to that tavern and you'll see these villagers like they know something and they feel some kind of guilt. And then, yeah, you see these two friends like frolicking around in the rain and then they get scared and it gets circled. And then that attack comes and this is clearly a horror movie. They got a lot of corn syrup gushing there. Like, they are not going to be afraid to show meat.
Does England have a history of werewolves? I associate that with Germany. I don't associate that with England.
Well, I mean, again, the very first werewolf movie in the talkie era was Werewolf of London.
Yeah, we saw it, but it doesn't really play. I thought there might be connections. I honestly thought that Landis might have studied that movie and would have Easter eggs, but it really, he just took the title.
Yeah, I mean, again, werewolves don't really come from anything except movies. I mean, there are shapeshifters in various myths in history, but the werewolf itself is a cinematic creation. And I think Landis was combining his love of the old Universal films with his own travelogue for this movie.
Yeah. So what's going on in this town? They have a werewolf problem, and they don't like strangers coming here because they don't want it to be found out. They are afraid of the exposure. They're worried about just these guys dying, or they're worried about who might come asking questions because Americans died on their soil.
All of it? Yeah, I think they want to protect people from being eaten or turned into werewolves, which would cause more werewolves, which is a bigger problem for this little village. And yeah, people are going to come knocking at the door at some point if random tourists are disappearing.
I would want help with my werewolf problem, but that's just me.
They know to stay holed up and stay on the main roads to stay away from the werewolf, mainly because it's a full moon, I guess. But the dissent among the group is, did we just send these two boys off to their death? By sending them out and saying, you can't stay here, are we consigning them to death? And they did say, stay to the road, and maybe the werewolf doesn't like cement or something? I don't know.
Yeah, probably not. Come on. They're dead, but you're very dead if you get off road and get lost like they do. And one is dead, and then one is saved, because the town actually has the capability of taking the werewolf out, and they hide the body. We will never know who the London werewolf was. This is about the American werewolf.
Right. They don't hide the body. When David wakes up in the hospital, they say, you were attacked by an escaped lunatic. And they have that body, and they had sent Jack back to the States, his corpse. And David, he was in a coma for 3 weeks. The one werewolf bite he got knocked him down for 3 weeks. And again, it's just a different time. Could you imagine your son is in a coma in London and you don't fly to see him? You don't go and check on him? The parents are just staying home in New England where they live and just getting updates from the embassy?
I can imagine it, honestly. I think that could be a joke. It might be funny. I would have liked to have seen the parents on the phone explaining why they wouldn't get on the plane.
And I'll back Stuart up. There has been a cover-up. When Scotland Yard arrives, like, they clearly don't want to investigate too much, at least the head guy. Like, it does feel like they know what's going on, and they just want a real quick cover story.
See, I don't think Scotland Yard knows anything. I don't think any of these Londoners know the truth. I think only the townies know what really happened. And they're willing to just chalk it up to this escaped lunatic story, which I don't know that that holds water. You would think if this is an escaped lunatic, he would have had to have escaped from somewhere.
Yeah, fingerprints would call this lie out.
That's why this is a cover-up.
So, I don't know. I guess I was hoping, one disappointment I'll have with this movie is that we would understand what was going on in this village, and we never understand the werewolf problem. It moves on. Once we're in London, we're pretty much staying in London, and we're staying on David, the sole survivor, who, yes, is going to be in a coma for 3 weeks for two reasons. One, we aren't interested in him until it's time for another moon cycle. It got to be the full moon. And two, it gives us a chance to do a whole lot of comedic bits or shock horror bits, jump scares with dream sequences.
I like some of these dream sequences, not just like the Nazi werewolf one, but even this one where you see him running through the forest, like naked, hunting deer or whatever. Like, again, if you're watching this for the first time, that you know this is a werewolf movie. It's in the title. Like, is this him already turning, chasing down wild animals? Oh, no, it's a dream. And like, so you're going to get this subjective view of what's going on inside his head.
I really like what I think is the first dream sequence slash jump scare when he's in the hospital bed and the nurse turns away from him. And you get just this shot of David's face. And it really looks like a vampire from Salem's Lot. His skin is blue, his teeth are fanged, he's got the yellow eyes, and probably the same contact lenses they used on Michael Jackson for Thriller. And it's just a blink and you miss it moment, but it's a really nice makeup effect that never comes back again.
Maybe that's why they call the movie what they call it, because would you know, based on this opening, they're so coy with what attacked him, I don't think we had a close-up of what killed Griffin Dunn. Would you know it's a werewolf? When would you know that? I don't think you'd know for an hour.
No, if you saw the trailers, which I did go back to watch, because I wondered how they marketed this. And first of all, trailers from back then really suck. But second of all, they really sold hard. This is going to be a werewolf movie you got to see Griffin Dunne as a zombie saying, you are a werewolf, you need to kill yourself, and things like that. So if you'd seen anything for this movie, you'd know this guy would be the werewolf. But if you just turned it on blind, like I did, it's only the title and the reputation that's going to let you know he's a werewolf, because it's going to be a long time before he wolfs out. It's almost an hour into the movie before he actually transforms. There's going to be a lot of this dream sequence stuff and just foreboding about becoming a wolf before he ever becomes the wolf.
Which is, I think, true to the genre. I think in most werewolf movies, you do wait a long time to see that transformation. That is considered in some ways to be the climax of the film, or at least the kickoff to Act 3. And so, what is this movie about then? It is about David coming to terms with that he is changing, that he wants to presume that everything is normal, but no, these dreams would indicate, particularly that one with his family. Yeah, when the werewolf Nazis burst in and execute them, they're a Jewish family at that, that, yeah, he's not going to survive this. There's doom.
Yeah, there's that strange moment where the nurse, when he's first in the hospital, is like, he's Jewish. How do you know? I had a peek.
I do gotta ask, is this the first, like, double jump dream scare? Like, you go from this Nazi werewolf attack, and then Alex, the nurse, comes running in when he wakes up from that, and then a wolf attacks her, and it's just another dream.
They got me. I will say that. I really thought, okay, one dream sequence, sure. But when she goes through the window, I don't have any presumption that a werewolf Nazi is waiting to stab her.
Landis had seen this in a different movie. I can't remember which one he cited, but it wasn't a horror movie. It was like a drama or something. And so he decided to use it for horrific effect. The Nazi werewolf is perhaps the main image I think of now when I think of this movie. It seems to be what's everywhere are these Nazi werewolves. And it's kind of a shame because Rick Baker, I'm going to compliment the hell out of him for this movie. But here, he just took some rubber masks, like the expensive ones from Spirit Halloween, and put them on some guys.
Yeah, it looks like it.
Yeah, I mean, it is some cheap looking, no movement, no articulation Nazi werewolf faces here. And it's funny if you can find Jews being slaughtered by Nazi werewolves amusing.
I mean, I don't know if that's even why I'm laughing. It's just such an outrageous image, Nazi werewolves. Yeah, not even thinking about the politics of what's going on. It's just, it's a funny image because it's not something you, like, I don't associate Nazis with werewolves or vice versa. So to smash them together like this, it's just a real shock to the brain.
So this is autobiographical, which is not to say that John Landis is a werewolf, but I'm guessing that you're telling me he worked abroad and a lot of these moments that are going to come are his adventures. He is David.
Yeah, and he is Jewish, and when he was trying to think what would be, like, the worst nightmare when he was thinking of it, Nazis and werewolves combined, you know? I mean, coming out of World War II, we're still in the shadow of that when this movie comes out. We're a lot closer to Pearl Harbor than to today when this movie came out. So, Nazi werewolves was his go-to for big scares.
And just to close the loop on that, the Nazis did use that word, that Hitler himself was into the occult, and some of his bases were named werewolves, and they cultivated that identity.
I do know about Isla She-Wolf of the SS, those exploitation films.
Same idea, right. Again, which is why I wonder if this wouldn't be better being an American werewolf in Berlin.
Well, if you're in Berlin, you can't have your hot British nurse, right? Because that's what a lot of the next part of the movie is going to be, is David flirting with Nurse Alex.
Another subgenre of the 80s. I remember there was so many nurse comedies. It was a thing. Young doctors in love. It was you could hook up with nurses. It was a fantasy for us in the 80s.
I just remember sitcoms joking about sponge baths. I didn't see a whole lot of nurse movies that weren't out of the back room.
Candy stripers, sponge baths, yeah.
Yeah, it was a thing, for sure. It was around. And, Jenny Agutter was a star. I mean, I know her, wouldn't have known her at the time. I was a child when this movie came out. But she had done Logan's Run. She had been in Walkabout, which is a really artsy Australian movie. She's now still a star. My mom watches Call the Midwife all the time. She's this old nun on that show. So Jenny Agutter been working since she's been five, and now she's, what, 60, 70 years old?
She was in Avengers and the Winter Soldier, if you recall. She was, when Black Widow pretends to be an old British woman, it's Jenny Agutter who she's pretending to be, the fake mask that comes off at the end when facing out with Robert Redford.
A lot of time is devoted to this, and I do think it's even framed as a doomed love story, that David, when he eventually has the understanding he is a werewolf, talks about the original 1941 Wolfman as a character that can only be saved by love. And that I do think that, however much we're laughing, we're not to laugh at the idea that these two are, again, this is a horndog American whose idea of romance is finally coming true. It's kind of a fantasy that she is, once he's discharged from the hospital, inviting him to come live with her.
And I don't know that their relationship really has any spark for me. I'm not really all that into it. I find it a bit strange that she would take this strange American home after he's discharged from the hospital. It seems like a bad personal choice on her part. And there's going to be quite a bit devoted to this romance. Quite a bit of time here. They're going to have sex to Van Morrison's Moon Dance. And I don't find it steamy. I want the movie to kind of get on with it. I'm enjoying the parts that come in through here, and there's not that many of them, where Griffin Dunne shows up as a zombie. The romance stuff with Alex, there's too much of it, and it drags.
I enjoy the romance stuff because you're told very on, like, it is doomed. Yeah, Jack is going to make a surprise return. How does he do it? Apparently, dark stuff is real, and, like, humans that die unnaturally just have to roam around the earth in limbo till whoever killed him dies as well.
And he's buried in New York. It's pointed out that his corpse was shipped home. So it's not like his physical corpse is walking around. He is a spirit, a ghost, a phantom. Or maybe this is all just in David's mind. Can this movie be read as psychological?
Oh, for sure.
It could to a point. It can't at the end. But to a point it could be. I think that's something that is being played with because the doctor thinks David needs therapy, thinks David has paranoid delusions, and that only David can see Jack is something that, yeah, this could all be playing out in his mind until a certain point. And Rick Baker, I dinged him for the Nazi werewolves, but this torn up Jack makeup is really great. It looks juicy and bloody and real, and it just really looks mauled and grotesque.
And I love he's going to decompose throughout the film.
Yeah, I agree. That is a nice added touch, is that he's never the same each time he pops up. Part of the fun is watching him wither. And he's got strong advice. It couldn't be more clear. Kill yourself. This is the only way out for you. You're going to murder other people, and killing yourself will free me of being your phantom.
I can't wait for the 2025 remake of this where they say unalive yourself over and over.
It is a little risky, though. I mean, I don't know that they were going for a teen audience, but you would probably not push this as a teen movie in the way Teen Wolf is.
It'd be a few more years before we got Heathers.
But as far as the romance goes, I think it's important that he has an attachment to London, because otherwise, why wouldn't he head back to home? And New York City. There has to be something to keep him. And they had that conversation in the beginning about he was looking for a woman. He was looking for something. Maybe you're right that this is not the most delightful scripted romance I've ever seen. They could probably cast actors that have a little bit more spark, but it's kind of hot. I mean, they're certainly naked a lot and there isn't sex. There's some chemistry going on between them, but it isn't a romance for the ages. I don't really know why she loves him so much. She seems to cite his tragic quality as the turn-on. She likes him because he is kind of sad and doomed.
And again, this is a tourist. She's going to let us know her body count later on. But yeah, you hook up, have a fun week or whatever, and then they go back to America. You move on. Like, it could just be that kind of thing as well. Like, here's some fun, and I know he'll leave, so it doesn't have to be serious.
I don't know. She's only had 7 lovers and 3... one night stands out of those.
You believe that?
Well, okay, fair enough. I believe that she wants him to believe that. And He does. And so, you're right. Perhaps we should see her more cynically. But to me, she feels like the naive one. She's the one that, I mean, cute or not, would you not be unnerved that your new boyfriend is rambling, I'm a werewolf, and having visions of people you can't see?
But he moves in with her around 35 minutes, and the moon dance sex scenes around the 40-minute mark. And then we've got 20 more minutes of movie in which we're going to see them hang out a little bit. And we're really going to focus on the doctor, Hirsch, who's trying to figure out what happened to David. And he's going to go to the slaughtered lamb and be researching all of this, which is A, outside the purview of any doctor, especially an internist at a hospital. And B, this is just a part of the movie I would think you cut. I think this drags so much in this section. The 30 to 60 minute part of this movie are honestly really dull.
I would say, yeah, if you want this to be a comedy, you cut all of his stuff. You don't really need it. I do wonder, and I'm coming from a position of ignorance. I've seen Christopher Lee in Dracula Hammer horror movies. I know they've done werewolf ones. This almost feels like, is this the Van Helsing of those films? This person that goes around doing I don't know because I haven't seen those, but that was my guess.
Yeah, it does have a Hammer horror feel to it. I agree. It's a strange inclusion that this doctor cares so much. He's certainly not an American doctor. I'll put it that way. American doctor is not going to try to figure out why this one patient that got discharged has a backstory that's so weird and that he thinks he's a werewolf. But yeah, for whatever reason, he's got a hunch. And he's not doing it for professional reasons. He's doing it because he's genuinely unnerved that this town might be sheltering a werewolf. Which again, all I'm asking from all of this is that he is the one that finds the backstory of the town. Why do they have a werewolf problem? What's going on? My disappointment is not that they're spending time on this, Arnie. My disappointment is that that doesn't get tied up.
Oh, I'll agree. That's my problem, too. If something interesting happened here, if there were great revelations, if we found out more backstory to the town or to the werewolf, then it wouldn't feel like the treading water that it is. I mean, he's going to have some conversation with the darts player. And the darts player is going to say, hey, this is what happened, really. But it's stuff we already know as the viewing audience because we witnessed it. And so it's just reiterating that for the doctor. It's not interesting to watch a character learn things we already know in a film.
Yeah, I agree. That's the problem, is that he's going to find out that David's a werewolf. And we've seen that by the time he figures that out. We already know that. So yeah, there should have been perhaps another mystery. Like, where did that original werewolf come from? Do they have those flowers from that Werewolf in London movie in this town? Who knows?
Yeah, the Marfasia flower, maybe. Yeah, they again, they're not even referencey and winky like that. This is not a 90s movie. They're not trying to make over connections to a 1935 werewolf movie. I think that, yeah, it just remains curiously underdeveloped. And I'm not sure how to take these doctor scenes. I wish that they did add a little bit more to the movie. I'll say this, again, change the title. Is it possible to watch this movie and have his discovery be like, oh, he's a werewolf? Wow, I didn't realize that that's what's going on.
Not the way it is, because you already had David appear and be like, you're a werewolf and kill yourself because when the moon gets full, you're going to hurt people. So we already know all this.
Yeah, I guess if they had this come earlier, before we had Griffin Dunn, I don't know. Yeah, I think you're right. It's filler. It pads this movie. And I do think that John Landis is a comedy director. And by that, I mean that he thinks in terms of bits and sequences. He doesn't think in terms of overarching stories. And so he probably just realized they need this for the runtime. They needed this movie to be 90 minutes. And the doctor is part of the reason why they were able to hit that desired runtime. But 54 minutes in, the nurse has got to go back to work. David is starting to feel the itch, and we have a very protracted montage to, what, Bad Moon Rising, that he is starting to change, and we're finally going to get that Rick Baker effect.
And it's great. It is probably the best werewolf transformation I ever have seen or ever will see. I'm not going to say it completely stands up today because I notice little things. I'm watching this on a 4K transfer on a big screen. I'm like, oh, that skin tone doesn't match exactly, and things that you'd never notice the first time you're watching this in a theater. But these practical effects feel very real. And I like what Landis brought to this, which is if your body is changing this much, it's going to fucking hurt. It is going to be a painful process for your body to transform. It's not going to be just sitting there in a chair and you grow some hair. It's going to be a metamorphosis. And it was Landis who wanted this to be like a big dog. Rick Baker wanted to do more like the bipedal Wolfman thing. And Landis is like, no, no. And Rick Baker had already been working on The Howling, and so he knew what The Howling was doing with bipeds. And so John Landis is like, no, we're going big dog, and we're going to change bone structure and musculature, and it's amazing.
Yeah, this is a transformation I feel as I watch it. You know, David starts off talking about how hot he is, and then you see the limb stretch. There is something about the way he ends up, like, laying on his back with his legs so they can all bend. I don't know, there's just something so troubling about that image.
The elongation, I mean, both, like, everything, the hands, the fingers, the chest even, the torso elongates, and it just, yeah, that's what really, like, pulling taffy, that's the part that you wouldn't expect. You always expect the fur, you always expect the fangs, but the elongation, the fact that he is literally going to turn into a wolf kind of, yeah, and he's going to lose the man part. This is a werewolf, not a wolf man.
And again, Elmer Bernstein wanted this to be really scary. Landis said, don't bother writing music for this. Bernstein did anyway, and Landis is like, nope, nope. I don't want that type of mood. I want to undercut this moment, and that's why we have Bad Moon on the Rise playing here.
And I totally agree with that decision. That's another thing that sells this moment to me. It doesn't feel like a cheesy horror movie with, like, the strings coming in with their stings and all that. It's almost like if you just turned into a werewolf at home, like, listen to whatever song came up on shuffle, like, this is what it'd be like. It feels like it should almost be comedic, but what you're seeing is so horrific, I'm just at awe.
Yeah, it looks good. I mean, I do think that, you know, you could poke at things. I'm surprising you guys are not talking about what's obviously prosthetics.
What is there to complain about this? Arnie's concerned about some skin tones. I don't care. Like, the downfalls are not enough to take the joy away from seeing this kind of physical transformation. I love this. This is why it was recommended to me. This is what the scene I was waiting for, and it did not disappoint.
Agreed. I'm just, again, I feel like you guys in particular can be hard on special effects that are 40, 50 years old. And yeah, this is, it shows its age. Arnie, you say this is the best that it will ever be. I severely doubt that, but it will probably be the last time we get an all-practical werewolf.
Well, it wouldn't be the last time. I know that they've made several Howling sequels and things. There will be a lot of practical werewolf transformations.
Okay, credible-looking ones.
Last good.
Yeah.
Let me insert the word good werewolf transformations.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen the Benicio del Toro Wolfman film. It's a good transformation. It's CGI. It doesn't hold a candle to this.
But what are we to feel? As you state, the music is kind of funny. The character is writhing in pain. We feel for him. So it's both kind of tragic comedy, but it's not scary. It's played for laughs that he picks off the people that he does next. That there's this couple getting out of a taxi going to a dinner party. And of course, they got to go around back and will never live to make it inside.
Yeah, this is the stuff. When you get to the kills, it's weird because it is very much going for that comedic effect with Sean and his wife sneaking around and thinking it's soccer hooligans. Yeah, this is very much going for yucks and not scares.
Well, I think that it may feel that way because after the big transformation, what Landis shies away from here is the gore. When we see this couple killed or when we see the three homeless men get killed, we basically see people sitting around going, what's that noise? And then we hear rawr and don't see anything. Landis has spent 40-some years regretting a decision he made. He apparently shot the homeless men getting torn apart by the wolf, and in test screenings, audiences reacted so strongly to it, he cut it out because they just wouldn't stop talking about it as the movie continued. And he cut that out. I saw him in 1981 being like, man, I should have left that footage in. And I saw him in like 2019, like, man, I should have left that footage in. And I think that would have changed the tone considerably, because as it is, yeah, it seems funny that we see these stereotypes getting just pulled off screen. If we had some gore and some people actually being killed on screen, I think it would make it more horrific.
I do think the subway kill is pretty good. Again, you're not going to see that gore like you mentioned, but it starts off funny. The stuffy British man going, I shall report this, like not knowing what's coming. And then you get that shot where he's like almost crawled up this escalator and you just see that wolf come in at like at the bottom, like just at the last moment. And there's something terrifying about that. Yeah, you're not going to get that gore, but I really like that shot.
Oh, I agree. This one is scary. Absolutely. The third death after the homeless men, after the couple, this is suspenseful. It's terrifying. The glimpse you get of the wolf, mostly it's first person point of view. You get wolf cam, but the glimpse you get of him as this guy's riding up an escalator and the wolf just stalks into frame is great. And Jacob, did you recognize the face of this Brit who's on the run?
I did not.
He would go on the next year to film Bib Fortuna in Return of the Jedi.
Well, he had like giant tentacles put on his head. I wouldn't recognize that.
Who's Bib Fortuna?
He's Jabba's like right-hand man that's always like whispering to him.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yeah, I won't call this a terrifying scene, but I do think that Landis lands it right. Horror comedies are a tough thing to do because it can tip usually in terms of farce too far and you end up with something like Nothing But Trouble. And here it is funny. And yet there is something unnerving about it. And I think that this scene in particular walks the line very well. One thing that may surprise you, though, is this is more or less it for Act Two. There are no more kills. There are no more struggles. I guess part of that is there's only a couple days of a full moon. We can argue whether he's got two nights of this before there's 30 more, or maybe three. But yeah, I guess you couldn't have continuous kills if it's lunar cycle.
No, we're going to break the tension. When the guy in the subway gets killed, we smash cut to a lion in a zoo, and David wakes up naked in the wolf pen, and we're going to get some comedy of a naked man running around a zoo, stealing a coat, stealing a kid's balloons to hide his dick.
A naked American stole my balloons.
And yet it's also, I mean, it's a bit sexual as well. And again, that werewolf mystique about, I don't know, are we worried? Here's what I'm trying to get at. If they have established for a long period of time that there's a love story, and we know that this guy is now a ruthless killer, does this set up the tension between him and Alex? Are you worried that the nurse is going to get it?
I am, because that's who he hangs around with most of the time. Like, she just happened to be at work that night, or else she would have been the first victim.
Yeah, I guess I'm just not worried. I don't like her enough to be worried, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's the thing, too. I don't care. When he goes back to her place, I think some of that wolfishness is in him. He just wants to get laid. He really wants to get her in bed. Meanwhile, she's been talking to the doctor and is like, I need to get you to see the doctor. The doctor's been researching stuff. And I don't care about her. I don't care about the doctor. I care about him and the choices he's going to make. And yeah, there's still like a third of the movie left. And it's going to just be watching him. And this is where I think the film turns. Where it goes from comedy to tragedy is when he realizes, oh crap, everything that Jack's been telling me is right. I need to kill myself.
Yeah, we're going to see him try to get arrested and at least thrown in a prison.
Yeah, the comedy doesn't stop. But I agree, there's something more severe about it. It's a starker, blacker comedy when you realize that, yeah, he gets in the phone booth and calls his family, holding a knife blade to his wrist. He really has to consider whether he can stay human. And it's almost like he's saying goodbye, that he knows that he's doomed. And were those vague words about, can the wolfman be saved by love, is that something that Alex has the power to do? She's nursed him back to health so far, but I can't think of anything that's been introduced that would lead you to believe that she could save him from his fate.
Yeah, and I don't know how you say the comedy is over when our third act's going to take place in a porno theater with a bunch of ghosts.
Right. Yeah, everyone that he's killed is now watching a porno and telling him how he could kill himself while spattered in blood.
Admittedly, I love that scene, especially the woman Judith from that couple, who is just so jolly to say all the different ways he could kill himself.
You must die, David Kessler! Yeah, she gives a great performance.
Feels very Monty Python. I don't know if Landis studied that at all, but they would have been very popular in America by this time. Just a flesh wound.
And yes, the fact that they're in this porno theater, and Landis filmed this porno himself, and the porno itself has some great comedy when, like, the guy walks in.
I thought this might be homemade, like, made for the movie.
Yeah. Guy walks in. You said you wouldn't do this again. I don't know you. No, her. I don't know you. But yeah, they had to do this to have some footage they could show in this porno theater. And this is where we see Jack at his most decayed. And he's obviously a puppet. This is an effect that is okay. But I like the little detail that Jack scratches his nose. The thought that they'd have a puppet, a dead puppet at that, think to scratch his own nose, that he has a little itch there, I thought was a nice touch.
I mean, Frank Oz is involved. I don't think he's puppeting stuff. Maybe he is behind the scenes, but he's got a little cameo.
He's not. Yeah, he does have a cameo early on. Twice, he shows up as the embassy ambassador, and then he also, we get a glimpse of the Muppets with Miss Piggy.
Yes.
Anyway, yeah, it is the climax of the movie. It might really surprise you to realize that there's no way out for him. They don't have scripted any more story for him, and that feels strange to me. It feels like the movie was just getting started being this werewolf tragedy, and it's over pretty quick. Spectacular. I will say this stuff here at Piccadilly Circus will take your breath away. I really love the absurdity of watching a giant wolf take on a double-decker bus.
He does the greatest cinematic scene ever again here, like the car crash in Blues Brothers. Like, he does that. It's a smaller scale here, but it's to such more horrific effect. Like, I am not laughing. I am not having fun as, like, before safety glass, just huge shards of glass are going through, like, people's necks as they crash.
Yeah, there's a lot of carnage here that you don't really see. And the fact that he was able to shut down Piccadilly Circus to get these shots, you know, the thing that I didn't realize until I rewatched it is you almost never see the wolf in this film. I believe that the total amount of wolf footage is less than a minute. I think there's more of the transformation than there is of the actual wolf. Here, you're going to get a few frames of the wolf here, or a few frames of the wolf there. There are all these car crashes, which of course made me think of Blues Brothers as well. John Landis does one of the stunts here. He's the guy who goes through the plate glass window. He does a little cameo as one of the stunts here.
Yeah, I don't know how you could make that wolf run around. It won't be able to in 1981. The look is great. When the Bobby walks into the porno theater and sees it chewing on a patron, like smeared in blood, great looking shot. But yeah, you're just not going to make that suit move like it's a lightning fast lupine. So they cut around it.
No, they had a way. They actually had a way of doing it, and there was footage that was filmed that Landis decided not to use. You couldn't see the full wolf, but you actually could see the front of the wolf the way we did in the subway scene. They have a lot of profile shots of the wolf running around Piccadilly Circus and things. They had some shots. I don't know if Landis didn't feel they were convincing enough, but in the end, the comparison Landis makes is Jaws. That Jaws worked because you didn't see the shark very much, and he wanted this to work because you don't see the wolf very much.
Of course, Jaws had a mechanical shark that didn't work, and they had to cut around it. And again, I'm still making that argument. I hear you saying that they had workarounds, but you couldn't do a full shot of the wolf running, galloping down the street. They do brilliant cutting around it. Again, the way that it steps out in traffic, I don't feel like it's a cheat. But it explains why suddenly the movie's over. They just can't do too much physically with this concept. The wolf is going to be limited by design.
Yeah, he's very bulky looking when we see him trapped in that alley. So it makes me wonder how much he could actually move.
He's killed the head of Scotland Yard, or at least the inspector that was never very close to finding out what had happened.
He was covering up.
It would make more sense if he was the guy investigating and not the doctor, but you're saying he's in on it.
That's my theory.
Maybe.
I don't think it was just that well thought out, honestly.
I think it's just a joke that he pops in to restore order and he's the first one to have his head ripped off. But yeah, it's over real fast. Jenny is going to go comfort her because she knows that this werewolf that everyone else is running from is her lover and is still willing to love him. But do bobbies have silver bullets?
Well, no, they say you don't need a silver bullet. They say that in the theater.
Yeah, in this universe, silver bullets aren't needed. It's just like killing any beast.
My question is, like, they set up this thing that, like, love could cure him? Do they mean that in an ironic way? Like, it calmed him down enough. Like, there was a second where they could shoot him before it was going to attack Alex. And that's how love cured him, by letting him die?
Yes, I think that, yes, he's taken out, and I think that's the cure.
I remember being so shocked when I first saw this film that Alex says, I love you, the wolf is shot, and that's it. Cut. Roll credits.
Blue moon.
I felt like I was robbed of some kind of denouement. I felt like there needed to be something more, and apparently other people have said that to Landis, and Landis is like, nope, wolf is dead, movie is over, you're done.
You want to see Jack, like, going off into heaven now that he's not in limbo anymore? I don't know. Like, again, this is part comedy, and so this plays comedic. Like, yeah, there you go. We resolved everything. Kicking the doo-wop blue moon.
That's the way I read it as well. Yeah, we're not asking for more of the story because this has been gags, and the joke has run its course.
So, Jacob Stewart, do you recommend An American Werewolf in London? Jacob.
I was really excited to revisit this one. It's probably been 5 or 6 years since I watched it last. And, you know, when I was telling my family, they're always asking, like, what do you got to review? What do you got to review? And I said, we're doing a Wolfman series. And one of my daughters was like, are you doing An American Werewolf in London? I'm like, yes. She's like, that is one of my favorite movies. I'm like, one of mine too. And this is why. And I asked her, like, what's your favorite scene? Like, why do you love this movie? She's like, oh, that scene in the porno theater, which, okay, that's a little disturbing, but, like, she's like, it's just so funny and weird with all these corpses yelling at this werewolf to kill himself. Like, where do you come up with that? And that kind of matches, like, the response that I had to this film when I fell in love with it. Like, why are there Nazi werewolves popping up in dreams? Why are there zombies haunting a werewolf and telling him to die and it resulting in, like, this climax in a porno theater? It is that, again, I don't know if that's ha-ha funny, but it's just this attitude. It's more about attitude than punchline. It's just like, we're going to do some real offbeat, weird stuff. And so, yes, Stuart, this is a comedy, but when it needs to be scary, it's also scary. You get that great transformation. I think the way they work around this having to be a practical effect and not being able to have a werewolf running around in the streets, like, I think they shoot around that well. They keep that tension up. And so it does play this balancing act that, yeah, it's funny and offbeat and weird and also scary. And you got some real great gore effects going on. Yeah, I agree, Arnie. Like, that doctor stuff is where it does kind of lag for me. The relationship, I don't know. I like the Bride of Frankenstein. I like Nosferatu. There is something about that gothic, melodramatic, like, doomed love, which, guys, I'm in a very happy relationship, but that does have an appeal to me, like, that doomed sense of love, and I think that plays around a little bit in this film. So, just a lot of different things going on, goes into places you would not expect, and that's the delight for me with this film. So, yeah, it's a very solid recommend.
Stuart.
Yeah, you know, Landis has done something very influential here. He has pioneered a hybrid genre that would become all the rage throughout the 1980s. The horror comedy ruled, from Ghostbusters, Fright Night, Gremlins. We didn't believe in the terror of horror anymore. We needed to be funny, and we needed the special effects to be a punchline. And God knows, Landis gets the balance between yucks and yuck just perfectly. I do think that directorially speaking, he's able to take gore and make it a punchline. And that, just the image of the werewolf, four-legged, howling at a double-decker bus, is grandly absurd and completely thrilling. I do think that he's got it tonally right. It will leave a mark on horror history, but I am going to stop short of calling it a great movie, because I do think that I kind of have the impression that Arnie does. There's something that happens in the middle of the movie that prevents it from fully transforming. And I think it's because Landis saw so much of himself in this main character that he didn't ask more from the others. We need to understand why this woman loves him so much. She needs to have a story of her own. We need to understand why this doctor is so invested. And we definitely need to have him find out what's going on at the slaughtered lamb. Why they're trying to protect werewolves. I do think there's plenty of room to deepen the horrific storyline so that it feels all the more tragic at the end. This is a creature that could be just as iconic as other boogeymen of the era. You know, Jason, Freddy, Chucky. You don't see this wolf brought up. You don't even remember David in the same way because, yeah, the script cared more about the gags than it did about selling his story. And I think that's what stops it short from being a truly great film. It's a funny comedy. I'm not over the moon with it, but it's a solid recommend.
3 for 3 on recommends. When I first saw this movie, it wasn't what I expected, especially since I had seen American Werewolf in Paris, so I had a completely different idea of what this movie might be. But coming back to it, especially given that we've seen other werewolf movies in the Universal series, and there have just been a lot of werewolf movies in general, I'm going to stake the claim that I think this is the best werewolf movie I've ever seen. I mean, I think about Wolf with Jack Nicholson, I think about Ginger Snaps, I think about a lot of different werewolf movies that get good marks, and I think this is the best of them. And I think that's because we really do get to know David as a character and watch his transformation. And I do think Landis does a great job of tone with this movie, which is a balancing act, but I think it starts out very comedic and transforms as a feeling of dread comes over it, and the movie tells you clearly David is not going to survive. The scene when David calls home to say goodbye to his family, and he's come to that realization too, there's no happy ending here. And the movie still has comedic elements, but I think the tragedy overrides any desire to laugh. And I think I was put off by that in my first viewing, and that there's so little shown of the legendary werewolf design. I think the first time I saw it, I just wanted more wolf in my werewolf movie. But now I appreciate the film for what it is, not for what I thought I'd get. But that said, I do have some complaints. I don't think it's a perfect film. The special effects were groundbreaking for their time. And like The Thing the year after this, I think it's worth seeing just to be amazed at what practical effects can do and how real it feels. But like I said, there's places where you can see the seams. There's places where you're going to know the fakery. And I think younger audiences will fail to be impressed with the transformation, as we older people who grew up with much worse can applaud it. I just don't know that millennials and zennials are going to find the fun in the transformation that I do. And again, those Nazi wolf masks are just cheap looking. And the movie lags a bit early on. It takes a long time to get to David's first transformation, and I just don't like Alex. But overall, I think those are quibbles. It's not a perfect movie, but it's a damn good one. And again, I'm gonna reiterate, best werewolf movie I've ever seen. If you think, listeners, there's one better, let me know what it is. And if I haven't seen it, I will seek it out.
I mean, we got Teen Wolf 2 coming up.
I mean, werewolves just came out in movie theaters. Frank Grillo is taking a machine gun to them. So maybe that is what we should have been covering. But I'll save that for another day.
But Stuart, you said you wanted some more information, backstory for the werewolf, things like that. Well, they've been talking about remaking this film forever. But in 1997, the BBC did a 2-part audio adaptation radio play of this with John Landis as creative consultant and some of the cast reprising their roles.
See, Stuart, don't tell me like we're the same as England. America would never do a radio play sequel or remake of this.
I mean, we did radio plays for the Star Wars trilogy in the 80s, but they got Jenny Agutter back to play the nurse. They got John Woodvine back to play the doctor, and they got Brian Glover, who was one of the people in the pub. They really expanded his role in it, and it starts with the lunatic escaping the asylum. The asylum knows they have a werewolf on their hands,
Wait a minute. There was a lunatic? There was an asylum?
Yes.
Okay, I wouldn't have guessed that.
Okay, there wasn't a cover-up, I guess.
In the radio play, they spell it out. It opens with, like, the people at the asylum trying to stop this guy from breaking out, and he turns into a wolf and breaks out, and that's the one who kills him on the moors. And then that guy goes on to be a ghost that hangs around with Jack talking to David. So you get a lot more information about this first werewolf, and the doctor finds out the whole history of werewolfism and how it's like a disease, and he can equate it medically, and he's really come to believe the werewolfing by the end of the film. And, man, you take Rick Baker away from this and give it all audio, and everything that drags in the movie, it's like an anchor dragging on the bottom of the seafloor for this radio play.
Why would you want to listen to that? This is about the visuals.
Yeah, I mean, again, I'm arguing it was a comedy that had punchlines made of latex. And to not show us that, you better come up with new kinds of jokes, is all I can say.
Yeah, they tried to have different kinds of jokes in it. They tried to be funnier with one-liners and things, but it just doesn't work. And a lot of the lines are directly from Landis' script, but it always is so clumsy in a radio play when they have to describe the visuals. We have the little boy, "Why are you naked in a bush?" And he's like, "Go steal that lady's coat over there."
Sounds like an M. Night movie.
It's just clumsy dialogue. I do not recommend the BBC audio production, but I checked it out because it was an expanded story with Landis involved. I was curious, what did they add to the mythos? They add quite a bit of the werewolf backstory to that mythos.
Yeah, but I think what I was really saying is I wanted it to have more meaning. Right now, it's a perfectly good, amusing comedy that doesn't have much there. Again, particularly if you can't see the visuals. Again, radio play seems like the total wrong direction. But I'm up for a remake, and I'm up for a sequel, except I don't think you guys or anyone else hasn't piled on to An American Werewolf in Paris. I've never seen it. I've never heard anything good about it. But I like Julie Delpy. It can't be all bad.
We shall see.
Famous last words.
I saw it in theaters and remember having a really good time with it. And I saw it, I think, once on video. I have only positive memories of it. So I know it's hated. I'm wondering if it's hated just because it's the sequel to a classic and maybe unrealistic expectations.
Not made by Landis. Should be said it's done by somebody else.
So I'll find out who that person is by next week and go back and revisit it. But I'm looking forward to An American Werewolf in Paris, though I remember it being a very different film. Again, I had seen American Werewolf in Paris only a few years before I saw American Werewolf in London. They both have comedy, but it's not the same kind of comedy.
All right, and on the main feed, more werewolves. If you want to know what happened to that London werewolf, I guess he got a bride. She-Wolf of London is coming on Tuesday. So check that one out as well.
So thank you for your support of Now Playing. Thank you for donating or pledging and joining us at the silver bullet level. We hope you enjoy as we get into these hairy reviews, both on the main feed and here on the donation feed. We'll be back next week with An American Werewolf in Paris. And thanks for the ride, sir. You have lovely sheep.
You can't let them go.
Should the world know our business?
It's murder, then.
Then murder it is.
It's in God's hands now.
Thank you again for your support of Now Playing, and we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus review.
Dumbass kids, they never appreciate anything you do for them.
It's your support that keeps Now Playing operating and putting out new shows without missing a single episode in over 300 weeks.
'Twas the sweetest, most courageous, and selfless thing anyone's ever done for me.
The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the views of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Why the hell are you so quick to disbelieve me? You think I'm crazy?
then Gonza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with, and this podcast has not been prepared, approved, or licensed by any entity that created the film analyzed herein.
The whole community is hiding the truth of what actually happened up there.
All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review, and no infringement is intended.
Whoa, check out the talent, man.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of and may not be used without the express written permission of Vinganza Media Incorporated.
Will not be threatened by a walking meatloaf.
Now Playing is a Vinganza Media production, copyright 2024, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Vinganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Hey, you.
That's enough!
That's enough!